Greetings, race community. Brent coming in live with today's guest, Patrick Hewitt, who serves as vice president for institutional advancement at Endicott College, but equally important, served as one of the first advancement professionals to ever give me feedback on the concept of Evertrue. Welcome, Pat, and thank you.
Thanks, Brent. Great to be here. So you mentioned like the term that we go back on these topics, and I was trying to do some research when we first started talking, and we did record something. What that recording was, I'm not exactly sure, but it was probably 10 or 11 years ago. But that's not even the start of the trail, because I was thinking about how I actually met you for the first time. I think you were sitting on Walt Doyle's couch in the offices of where, if that was even
77 Washington Street in the North End. I remember exactly that moment.
I was going to ask Walt to be the chair of his 25th reunion class at Middlesex, and there was young, I will say much thicker, Brent Grinna, you know, trying to conceive of this this idea that wasn't called Evertrue at the time. Evertrue was like you guys were broken up into two different ideas, right?
It was the very initial concept. And in fact, I've got the email where Walt introed us in February of 2011. And so I must have pitched you my concept, a mock-up. I'm not sure if it was even like a functional application, but the first version of Evertrue, it was like, visualize your alumni network on your phone, right? There's an app for that. And Ware was one of the kind of emerging leaders in the mobile application community in Boston. And so Walt Doyle had become a mentor of mine. Pat was working at the Middlesex School trying to drum up support for reunion. And I've got an email from you after the meeting, and you wrote, "That's awesome. I haven't seen anything like it. I think this might cause my BlackBerry Pearl circa 2007 to spontaneously combust in my hand. Other than that, very cool. In regard to my job, I'm always on the road setting up appointments and filling in gaps in my schedule. This would be hugely helpful, especially if it was possible to link this app in real time to our database so that I would always have up-to-date giving information and access to my notes and reports. Good idea, Pat." Thank you.
Look at us now.
We did it. I mean, but like, this is, you know, for people listening that have been on the journey with me over the years, like, this is literally how this stuff happens. Like, got to know Pat. He's sort of the classic road warrior explaining, you know, I think you guys were on like Millennium or something at that time, and sort of being able to get firsthand advice of just like a perspective of, you know, what is the job? How are you doing the job? What is the pain today? And sort of, I feel like, you know, in April of 2025, we're still attacking some of the issues, though I'm super proud of the progress we've made. And it wouldn't have happened without people like you giving us the time and the feedback early on.
Well, it's amazing how much has, obviously, I mean, things that have changed since 2011 are pretty profound. But fundamental things really endure. And I think that'll be some of the things that that I talk about, or that maybe that we talk about today, that things are changing really rapidly. But I think that there are some fundamentals that really endure. And one that, you know, just your reflection there connects to, last night on campus, we hosted Sean Astin, Mikey from Goonies, and Rudy. And so I had a chance to introduce Sean, and he was giving this big community talk on, he's a big mental health advocate, which I didn't really appreciate his connection to that topic, but he got this question from the audience, and the questioner is a mental health professional, and she was asking, like, you know, she was really inspired by his, you know, his story and all the anecdotes he told and how he connected it all together. And she was having, like, how do I, like, I'm not Sean Astin, how do I take this to another level? I want to speak from, you know, from higher perches. And he told another great anecdote. He talked about how, so Sean Astin is a child of two famous parents, right? He was a child actor, his parents were actors. And he remembers his publicist telling him when he was going out for his first audition, he was like, I wanted to be an actor. And he said, well, how do I do that? And the publicist said, tell everyone. And like, so his point about tell everyone is that there's no audience when you're passionate about something, when you in your bones, you feel like you have an idea that matters. There's not like the idea of networking is like is really cheap and like when you you know when you go into a room with people and an idea that you really care about, there's not a person in that room you shouldn't be telling about that idea. If you have no idea who the person is who's gonna you know introduce you to the next person and that string like that that was the whole his point was there is no strategy. I mean you can try, but the strategy is to tell everyone and to have genuine investment, like personal investment in what you're doing and to believe in it, because that's, you know, that there's no like, you know, LinkedIn like AI that's going to navigate your, you know, your path to success. It's like that connection you have to what you care about and able to make other people engage and feel that, that sense of why what you care about is important and why you're someone who's special who's going to make something happen in that space. And I just thought that that was last night. And, you know, hearing about, you know, just doing that quick reflection on where you started and how you, I think how you went about doing it, right? Like I was, I'm still not really anybody, but in 2011, I was truly nobody, you know? And we had a really, you know, we shared an interest in something that we thought was important. And these were two nobodies talking to each other. And, you know, 15 years later, I think that obviously like there was a genuine, what you were doing, you genuinely cared about. You had a deep and authentic enthusiasm for. And I mean, I'm sure you had great mentors from all kinds of really fancy, you know, management consultants and HBS grads and people who are giving you like really like good advice. And none of that would have mattered if you didn't have this deep reservoir of enthusiasm and a true belief in what you were doing to make a difference. And, you know, there's no HBS, you know, memo that's gonna make that come to life. So
It's funny you say that, Pat, because back in, and thank you for the reflection. And, you know, back then, right, when you're trying to start a company, and at some point we're going to get into like, who are you? And, you know, my kind of standard raise, you know, setup here, but we're just diving right in, which is great. But, you know, back then I remember every single investor that I met with pretty much universally said the same thing, like you, love the concept. The market is way too small. This is not a good market. What are you doing? Why are you pursuing this market? And they would draw up on their whiteboards, like, here's an example of a big market and why we're excited about big markets. So now let me do the math around how big Evertrue could be if you have this many colleges and they pay this much money and you get this much market share and it just can't be big enough and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I was like, I don't care. I don't care. Like, I'm not sitting here trying to optimize my life relative to market sizing to maximize financial outcomes. Like, I believe that there is a massive opportunity to solve problems like the ones you shared in that email, that your BlackBerry 2007 wasn't getting done. And it doesn't have to be the biggest idea in the world for me to go and pursue it. And that was really like the tension I felt early on. And unfortunately, I spent too much time trying to convince investors it was huge. It was a huge market. Like, now I'm like, what was I doing? It's not a big market, but it's a super tight knit market. People are incredibly collaborative. They come to this industry because they genuinely care. And if you can put one foot in front of another, you can build a good business, which we've done, even if it's not right, the Uber back of the envelope math. And I feel like, you know, that's kind of where we are today. And as much as I loved talking to you in Walt's office in 2011, I mean, I still love doing that. And I love having conversations like this one and have been on the road recently a bunch and have a lot more of that upcoming. So appreciate it. And I do want to get to like your journey, right? Your journey. And I've loved learning from over 200 guests now. Right, your path into this industry that nobody knows exists when we're in middle school, right, for the most part. And so take me back to high school. Who was that, Pat? What was he into? And what led you to St. A's, St. Anselm College?
Yeah, I think in many ways, I was probably more similar, you know, 17-year-old Pat is more similar to 43-year-old Pat than probably a lot of people. I think, you know, probably was, you know, a lot of heart and, you know, felt a lot more than, you know, I was, an okay student, not super focused, but sort of really could get really into ideas and could really, when something grabbed my attention, could really go deep into it and maybe not even score that all that well on a test, but be genuinely excited about it. And so that was at Portsmouth Abbey School in Portsmouth, Rhode Island. And so that was my experience. And there were some great teachers there. That's a wonderful school. And, for someone like me who had, kind of wandering attention, to be able to sit in small classrooms with really smart people who, had deep passion for what they were talking about, that was a really good combination. I was very fortunate to be there. And then, very practical sort of next steps. So Portsmouth Abbey's a Benedictine high school. There aren't many Benedictine high schools in the country, and St. Anselm's one of the few Benedictine colleges in the country. And so they had, at the time, I don't think they do anymore, they used to have a Benedictine scholarship. And so, I wasn't, necessarily like batting away NESCACs, on my college transcript. And so I did, I did some back of the envelope math on my whiteboard with my parents. And they said, St. Anselm's like half tuition seems pretty good for you, Pat. And it's a good school. And it was. St. Anselm was a great fit for me. It was a place I could play football, which at the time and even to this day was a really important thing to me. So, it was a great fit. Again, sort of like, I think that I was better served by kind of smaller environments, really community feel. So went to St. A's, had a great 4 years, met my wife, played some football, did some more of that kind of, wrestling with big ideas. And then took a really uninspired first job in the insurance industry. Fortunately rapidly rescued at the end of my first, I feel like the first job I was given advice, like almost like it's a penance, like you have to do it for a year, like get to 12 months and then you can look. So I did my 12 month penance in insurance, and, Portsmouth Abbey, Patrick Burke, who at the time was the head of development at Portsmouth Abbey, who'd gone on and led big development shops. And
one moment, just walk me through a day in the life of a first year insurance professional.
I will say the advantage to that job, so I was on the claim side of the business, which is, so the downside is you're dealing with everyone in their worst day, right? So they've just smashed their car, or a tree's fallen through their roof, or something calamitous and awful has just happened to them. And that's the frame of mind with everyone that you're talking to on a daily basis. So that was, that was a downside. On the plus side, and this is very different to what I found in advancement work, I showed up every day on the left side of my desk with a new stack of files, new trees that had fallen on roofs, new cars that had crashed. And my job was to move those claims across my desk and get, process them, work the investigation and get it on, right? So I didn't have to turn my brain on. Like, work found me. And so that was, that was sort of easy. Like, the work was sort of really grinding and hard. But the process of finding work, it came to me. It literally arrived at my desk. So that's how I would characterize the insurance world. It was grinding. It was sort of unrewarding. You weren't necessarily having these really positive and inspiring interactions with humanity. It was sort of dealing with folks on their worst day. So I got out of that, and Pat Burke took a chance on me. I think my first job at Portsmouth Abbey, it wasn't really a job. It was more of like an internship. I think they paid me like $14,000 to develop a young alumni program. They didn't have one at that point. And I coached football, basketball, baseball. Year two, they added, I was a dorm parent, so that may have thrown an extra $5,000 onto the pile. So I may have cracked $20,000 that second year. But I loved it. I love the coaching part. I continue to look. I've got kids now who I coach, and so I love being a part of the community. And I started to like understand it was that job. I was like, oh man, I never really understood that development was a career. So I was really enjoying what I was doing. I was making peanuts, but I was living in a free apartment on Narragansett Bay, which I know you can appreciate, Brent. I was on the other side of the bay, but the stripers in blue still run on that side. And so life was pretty good. I got engaged to a woman who is from this like sitcom quality Irish Boston family, that is anchored firmly. We live in Milton. Her entire family lives on our street. So it was a very brief negotiation over where we would reside. So ended up taking a job at Middlesex. They were launching their second ever capital campaign. I remember the time it was MX2, which was they were going to double the size of their previous campaign, which I think, and this is credit to Jim Zimmerman and the team at Middlesex, I think that the $125 million campaign they had done, the campaign for Middlesex, was the largest independent school campaign ever at the time that they did it. So MX2 was going to double the size of that. And it was a very, you know, Jim's a very clever guy. And so there was great branding and we had some great punchlines. I will say, like, at the time, this is going to be relevant to sort of what I talk about in terms of my philosophy and what I think about fundraising today. It was challenging. And when I think back on it, I think about the challenge of that campaign was, like, Middlesex was awesome. Middlesex was exactly what I think it wanted to be, which is, that's a good thing. If you can be a school that is exactly what you want to be, you know, serving the students you want to serve with exactly the type of faculty you have, like the sort of like the perfect campus that meets your needs, like that's a really, with endowment to sustain it and all that, it's a you're like a snow globe, right? And so fundraising is really around, like, how do we preserve this thing that's sort of perfect? And I think that, you know, there's still donors who there's still a generation of donors who are so institutionally aligned that they see the perfection of that quality and want to help you preserve things. But I think that the donor taste, and there's lots of great data about this from the Lilly School and Bank of America does a great philanthropy analysis every year. And those things have been really consistent over the years, that philanthropic tastes are changing. And sort of the younger you get, the more cause-based, you know, philanthropists are, right? So less institutional-based, more cause-based. And I think that's, we're starting to see that, especially with maybe the portfolio that I was managing of younger, sort of newer philanthropists, you know, this idea of just preserving things that are good, you know, the institution that you went to is was starting to kind of melt a little bit. And we didn't have a great pitch at the time, and they probably do now, around like to meet people around the causes they care about, right? So let me like make that less abstract. You know, when my dad, take some of my dad's 83. You know, someone with his profile supports their local hospital, their place of worship, so it could be their church or their synagogue, the school that they went to and the school that their kids went to. That's kind of the profile of, you know, in their generation, actually, the church or synagogue is probably the number one thing. And if you take their kids or grandkids, it's like sort of that triangle is inverted. You know, where today, you know, and I'm looking out the window at Endicott, most of the 3,000 students out here, as they start to think about giving and to start giving, they're likely going to be aligned with causes. So it's not going to be the institutions that they have, you know, may have grown up around, and maybe they didn't actually really engage that closely with institutions. It's going to be the causes they care about. So it could be the environment, it could be LGBTQ, it could be any number of things. And they're going to, statistically, they're going to align with that interest and find the, you know, the organizations that are doing the best, most important work that they can find in that sort of cause vertical. So, you know, for schools or for colleges, and I've gone way off the tangent of how I got into development, but I don't know. Well, here we go, Brent. You know, I think the challenge for us is, like, we can't, Endicott can't turn itself into a synagogue. We can't turn ourselves into an LGBTQ, you know, support nonprofit. We're a college. But we have, you know, inside this college, we have dozens, hundreds of interest areas, right? We have a sustainability and environmental program. We have an LGBTQ, and we also have, like, a big mental health and there's a program and center. And so there, we've got an athletic program for folks who are, you know, who are really aligned with that and value that. So there's all of these interest areas that if we can kind of break ourselves down and into, you know, sort of bite-sized pieces for our constituents, I think that's a way for us to do a couple of things. One is to meet donor interests where they're, you know, where they're evolving into. There's another thing too, I think, especially for colleges where, you know, any alum from the last 20 years, you know, go out and talk to people. There's much more cynicism about supporting their college than their parents had, because, you know, people my age and younger, you know, they carried student loan debt, oftentimes in significant loads, into their, you know, mid-30s, early 40s. And so that's a, you know, trying to engage I think, if you're at Endicott trying to engage people, the idea of supporting Endicott, that's the institution they associate with their last, student loan payment. But if you talk to them, if they were a baseball alum, you're talking to them about Brian Haley and, Coach Haley and the outstanding, success that program's having, the huge impact he had on them as a, as a young, in the case of baseball, as a young man, coming of age and growing and maturing. If you talk to them on that level, all that cynicism melts away.
Sure.
And so, that's what we're trying to do. I think that, Evertrue, in the technology that Evertrue not only developed, but I think also helped to force the industry to start to, to develop smart, efficient ways to be able to speak to our constituents on these sort of granular issue-based levels, that didn't exist in 2011. It was really hard. It was very manual. And I remember the last time we spoke, it was in part because of a little project I had taken on at BU. So I after Middlesex, I went to BU, worked on a really big campaign there. And that was a really formative experience. At BU, we got, Evertrue was really starting to come to life. And I remember you guys had this breakthrough that allowed keyword searching through contact reports. And so I thought that was really cool. And so I wanted like a test case to sort of say like, all right, could we build something from scratch within BU? And so BU had, at the time, had just launched this Institute for Sustainable Energy. And so the idea that I had at the time was, all right, this thing does not exist. It didn't exist yesterday. It exists today. There's not a single, BU alum who's ever contacted this thing. There's not a parent who's contacted it. It doesn't issue degrees. There never will be an alum of this thing. It is like fresh driven snow. Can we build an advisory board of people who would, who would give $10,000 a year to it? So can we? And so I remember using, Evertrue as this tool to say, all right, let's like take 330,000 BU alumni. And let's start to narrow it down and figure out who cares about, because it was going to be about what people care about. Well, who's ever supported like the biology program, or who's ever, who's giving has ever sort of indicated an interest in sustainability? Who's ever mentioned in a contact report to some advancement officer 10 years ago that, hey, if you guys ever do anything green, like, let me know. I I'm not interested in the business school, but if you guys ever do anything about the environment, look me up. Well, that contact report got filed 10 years earlier, and no one knew that person, that prospect had said that until we could keyword search, right? Now I can start to, look at data around giving. I can start to keyword search and identify interests. And we were able to take 330,000 alumni and drill it down to like 1,100 people. And they get down to 1,100 people. Now you can start to do some like actual outreach. Like that's a manageable number. And so, I don't know, I got way off point about how I got into development, but that journey is what took me. I mean, I guess it started with, it was convenient and it got me out of insurance, and then I started to understand that it was a career potentially, and then I got exposed to people like you, and I got exposed to some other smart people at Case. I saw what at the time at UConn. Brent, help me out. Who was the head of development at UConn at the time?
It could have been Josh Newton.
Josh Newton. So I saw him give a presentation, and it may have been at Evertrue, it may have been at a Case conference. And I was like, oh man, he was running development at UConn. I was like, oh man, like this is the things that he was talking about, like, excited me. That this.
I think
this
it was probably at our RAISE conference, which we need to bring back.
Yeah, maybe. I think it probably was. And there just weren't a lot of people, at the time when I was doing, when I was coming up in this work, there weren't a lot of people who were talking in this way about how to do things smarter. And
some of what you're describing, though, it's kind of like back to your, like, literally the first email you sent saying, imagine if I could access donor information on my phone in real time with the database. It's like, yeah, that you should be able to do that. And then as we got to continue to collaborate and get to know people like you, I didn't know anything about the pain point of creating advisory board around a new initiative with no existing constituency and how you sort of are living in this word of mouth game. But it was obvious that the amount of data that was locked away in traditional database systems, it was almost like, you know, there was this sort of Fort Knox of the database to the point where it was so protected, not even fundraisers could use it to do the job. It sort of became this like data repository that unless you were super advanced, you basically couldn't access. And then you'd have to submit a request to research. They might not even be able to do it. You know, days go by, et cetera. And so just the idea of like, why can't I Google my database? You know, it's like, there's no reason. And I feel like we've all along just been like, okay, what are the new sort of technology waves that exist? When we started, it was cloud, it was mobile, it was social. Okay, well, like clearly this stuff should be in the cloud. It should be super easy to access on mobile. And yeah, you should be tracking if people are like writing on BU's Facebook page that they are passionate about sustainability and you're a fundraiser trying to fundraise sustainability, you probably want to know that, right? If somebody is like updating their job on LinkedIn into green energy and you're trying to figure out who from BU might be a fit, you should probably know that. And so it's just like one step after another of trying to look at the technology waves that were happening outside of the industry and then just say, all right, like, what are the implications for the industry? And it's fitting because now in 2025, obviously there's another version of that with generative AI. And what I'm so excited about is it builds so beautifully on all of these past trends. It builds on mobile and the ability to do voice, like have conversational voice experiences. You know, that needs to be a bigger part of fundraising going forward. You shouldn't even have to write fat thumb your way through the Evertrue app if you can just have more voice-driven discussions. There's the ability to start to make sense of all of that historical contact report, the data around social engagement, even simpler than, you know, keyword search, because as big of a step forward as that was, it's still super clunky relative to how streamlined it could be when you think about conversational chat experiences that we're now all becoming used to. And so it just feels like I don't know what the next wave is going to be. I'm not inventing, like I didn't invent mobile. We didn't invent social. We're not inventing AI. But if we can just sort of hang around the hoop, watch these trends evolve, there just aren't enough people applying them to philanthropy, right? They're being applied to every other industry that's trying to sell us stuff that, by the way, have much bigger market shares and all the back of the envelope math. There's a lot of potential to apply it to the sector.
Yeah, and I think it's, and this is not limited to advancement communications, but it's you know, we, whether it's generative AI, I'm actually interested. I'm not fully, you know, sort of tuned into what the potential is for generative AI in the IA world and our use case. But I do know that like one of the major problems we suffer from is the inability to distill signal from noise, right? When we're communicating, we are, you know, through the traditional means that we communicate out to our constituents, we are just in a, we're just pumping noise into this hyper noisy chamber. And on the other end is our constituent who is watching their Gmail inbox, like the odometer run to like 5,000, 10,000, 50,000 unopened emails that are just junk, right? And so they just, that becomes a dead space for trying to get signal to your constituents. You know, traditional mail, you know, maybe makes a comeback, I don't know. But again, super noisy and people just aren't engaging with it. And I think that, you know, you guys both in your own marketing, the way that you market Evertrue, but also like the way you've been advising the development space for years around authentic, like constructive content, right? Like how do you like create, you know, signal to the person that you're trying to create it, create signal to. And, you know, whether that's, you know, just high quality, well-produced content or, you know, using the right person, the right advocate, ambassador on campus whose face or voice like activates that constituent. Like, you know, if you're trying to, you know, generate an act, you know, on a, or create a conversion, whatever that conversion is, to come attend an event, or to make an annual fund gift or whatever the conversion that you're seeking from that person, we're really up against it for getting that person, even the person who is inclined to you know, deliver that conversion, they're just not hearing us, right? They're not hearing the ask to come to that event or to make that annual fund gift because it is just blotted out by the noise in the communication space. And so I think that's one of the big challenges. I think generative AI, that helps us to get much smarter about delivering, like, you know, the piece of con, you know, the piece of information from the person who's most likely to generate the conversion. I just think that we need to become more and more sort of laser precise to try to cut through the noisiness.
Yeah, look, I think there's kind of, and we haven't talked that much about generative AI, probably not enough, and maybe we can make that a follow-up after this. But the way that I've been framing it to our community is really, there are like four pillars of data that I see being married in a way that's going to radically improve the donor experience and make the job of fundraising a lot more fun, I think. And it's really this idea of private donor data, all that CRM data that, frankly, when you think about what Endicott has on file about their constituents relative to what most brands do, huge advantage. I mean, I bought something on Etsy the other day. Like, what does Etsy really know about me? My name, my address, couple things that I've purchased, and they can do some enrichment things, but they don't have even close to the breadcrumbs and the history that Brown University would have about me, for example. And so as much as I feel like the advancement industry likes to express frustration about the quality of the data, et cetera, it's like, you don't know how good you have it. You have such an incredible starting point relative to literally every other industry on the planet. Okay. So there's that data. The challenge is it's been like really hard to access, and there are things that we've done to improve it, right? The next piece is what I'm going to call public donor data. And that, I think our first step was around, right, LinkedIn and Facebook and some of these other, you know, platforms. But the way that we're going to be able to like truly build a composite about public Pat Hewitt and the digital profile across the web and news articles and wedding announcements and a lot of the things that in the past researchers went and they found one by one and they copied and pasted into the bio, and then the bio is on a shared drive that's disconnected from the database, and they're copying and pasting things from the database. Like, no, we're going to have a living and breathing version of Pat Hewitt that is part the digital web, part the private CRM data, and then there's other data pools at different institutions when you think about ticketing data, when you think about, you know, other engagement data. Okay, so bringing all that together, well, now you've got a really good view of who this person is as a human, and then who they've been as a supporter to our institution. And then the other two data pillars are, let's call it private institutional data, those campaign reports and the impact areas and the research needs and all of the things that you work on around a campaign. And then I'll call it public institutional data, right? That baseball coach that has the you know, press release about the retirement and all of the things going on, and Sean Astin being on campus. Like, in the center of those four data points, public and private donor data, public and private institutional data, there is something that is the absolute best fit for every human being in your community that is unique to them. And we need to help a fundraiser understand, and we're not going to know for sure, but we should be able to radically streamline the ability to understand, you know what, it's probably going to be sustainability, it's going to be baseball, or it's going to be mental health. And here are the footnotes, citations, the reasons, the dots that we have connected to get to that, so that the donor experience is not blasting the inbox with generic content, but Pat, I wanted to let you know that coach so-and-so is retiring, and I thought you might be interested in knowing more about what we're doing to honor them. It's not give to Endicott before June 30th. It's a radically different message, even though it's give to Endicott.
And I think, you know, I would build one of, you mentioned that the big challenge is like accessing data for us. I think that that has been a challenge, but I think actually the bigger challenge that faces this sector is like the expectations of our constituent are so much higher than your expectations are of Etsy, right? Like, you may, like, consumers have come to expect Etsy to know more, but, you know, when you send a like a generic email from Endicott to a constituent, that's just so like someone who's like emotionally invested in Endicott gets this clearly disconnected, or like that's such a letdown, right? Because their you know emotional connection to the institution is peaked. It's like it's intense. And when we're sending stuff that's super generic and uninteresting, and like there's a bigger letdown than there is for like the Etsy customer getting like the working, and Etsy's working with worse data, so it's harder. I think that's the biggest thing that we really work against is just
And I think as a fundraiser, this is something I was going to ask you about. But one of the reasons I was saying I think this is going to make fundraising a lot more fun is because, like, you worked at Middlesex School, and most people listening probably don't really know what that is. It is a pristine, beautiful, tight-knit, small, independent boarding school in the Northeast, and you're living on campus or you're really connected to campus. You know pretty much the whole faculty and staff. As a fundraiser, when somebody says, "Hey, Pat, how's Mr. So-and-so?" you actually maybe know the answer, or you can really easily get it. You then went to Boston University, polar opposite, 330,000 people, not as much of a tradition of giving at that point, not multi-generational in the same way that Middlesex might have been at that time. And the alumni don't care. I'm sure you got asked questions as a fundraiser at BU all the time where they would just assume you know every faculty, every initiative, every program, every building within your first month on the job. Like, how do you do this as a fundraiser? And I feel like that's part of where, like, you can't, you shouldn't have to, but I think with AI, you can get a lot smarter, a lot faster to be able to answer those kinds of questions, which make the donor feel felt, heard, seen.
I 100%, that's an important and bright future. And can I be so bold as to pivot onto? I feel like we've been like waxing on important things, but this is a really sort of dramatic inflection point.
Let's go
in the higher ed sector. You don't have to search the news too hard to see where higher ed is undergoing this rapid reset, is under enormous pressure, and it's not limited to advancement, but it definitely affects advancement. I mean, Harvard received an order last week to turn over all their donor records to the federal government. These are like really important things that are putting the whole sector kind of through the ringer, including institutions. I've worked at institutions that I think like in 2008 were like highly affected and by that financial collapse. And there have been, I think, since that point, you're seeing colleges and independent schools that have been under a lot of like enrollment pressure because you've got shrinking demographics. You've had a lot of things sort of working, like big, powerful factors that are impacting the higher ed sector, the independent school sector. And those things, I think, just got like a SpaceX rocket attached to their back about 3 months ago. It's something that I've been thinking a lot about, which is, all right, so how do we fundraise in this moment, or in this new, it may not be a moment, it may be a new sort of reality. So I've been thinking a lot about that, and I'm sure that many of the people who listen to your podcast are in a similar position and thinking a lot about that. And so, for me, what I've kind of settled on is, I mentioned earlier in the podcast that the fundamentals are kind of, in my mind, are kind of resurrecting. So for me, I go back to like, are we creating value, and how are we creating value? Like, what is the thing that needs doing, and how are we as an institution, prepared or able or qualified to do something about that thing? And I think that where advancement shops need to play, are going to play an important role for their institutions in this new reality, or in this moment, is helping the institution think about, like, all right, what are the things in the world that people care about? What do our donors care about? What are they talking about? What are they saying to us? What are the issues? They're worried about the breakdown of civil discourse. They're worried about, I'll touch on some things that we're working on at Endicott. So the breakdown in civil discourse, or the health, you know, the broken workforce development, you know, pipeline in the healthcare sector. You know, those are things that we've been hearing people talk about here in our community, and that we think we have, like, you know, we are well suited to play a role in addressing. We at Endicott may not be well suited to address every issue that our constituents are worried about. If they're worried about, you know, a spike in, you know, childhood cancer, you know, like, that's not, you know, we don't do, you know, oncology research. We don't do pediatric oncology research at Endicott. So that's probably one that we need to, you know, if there's a temptation to enter that space, you know, someone in my position, I think, has a role to say, I don't know if that's, like, you know, do we really want to go there? We have the resources to make a dent there. What about, hey, look, we have, here at Endicott, we've got a nursing school that's, like, really top notch. We've got a huge problem with, you know, with the nursing pipeline that we're hearing from all of our, you know, our community constituents. You know, we're hearing from the hospitals, you know, we're hearing from our alums, our nursing alums, how under pressure they are, how fatigued they are. You know, we have, and no one seems to be solving this problem, right? So what can we do? And we have, you know, in the Institutional Advancement Office here at Endicott, but at most of the institutions, if not all the institutions that are listening, you know, you have this unique vantage point to be, you know, fielding input from all of these different constituents into the, you know, developing a composite sort of idea for how, you know, how your institution can be stepping in. And I think it's an opportunity for the advancement offices, the development offices, to play more of a role. Like, and I know, Brent, you come from the for, you know, originally from the for-profit world, I guess you're still in the for-profit world. You know, we're business development, right? Who's looking on the hillside for new opportunities for your institution to create value for the world, create value for the community they sit in? You know, where is the work that needs being done? I think that we can help inform that conversation and connect our institution to the resources that will help make that possible. At Endicott, it's particularly acute. We don't, you know, we don't have a native alumni population that looks like, you know, the HBS alumni population, which is, you know, a target-rich donor, alumni donor pool. We have huge ambitions for an institution. We have a really positive balance sheet. We've got a lot of things going for us, but we don't have just a native alumni constituency who can write, you know, huge checks today to help us launch, you know, new ventures at the peak of our ambition. So we need to be able to go out and make a case to, you know, whether it's foundations or just philanthropic individuals who care about those causes, and reach beyond our traditional alumni population and parent population, and really make the case that what we're doing, you know, to address a problem they care about is something they should pay attention to. And so that business development role on campus, you know, understanding the landscape beyond campus, what are the needs of the community? What are the needs of society? What competencies do we have to connect and address those? And then how do we go out and find the resources? I think that's always existed to a degree. I think it's rapidly expanding. So it's not just, go ahead.
Here's what I'm thinking though. I'm thinking back to the email you sent me in 2011. And I think there's a version for college saying, for universities to say, what do you need? Employers, what do you need? What are the skills? And obviously some of this is happening, but I think this is what you're touching on, where, like, we have product managers who are trying to listen to end users and listen to customers to craft solutions at a price point that work for our market. I think you're just saying that's what colleges need to do.
Yep.
Whose job is that? That has not historically been the faculty, the dean, you know, what people, it's been so inward, right? Like, this is our campus, inward, our culture. And I think what you're describing is how do we just identify that intersection of, right, career development, maybe corporate philanthropy, regional economic development, and then the role you can play to design better products and better prepare students to hit the ground running. And I love it. How do you do that?
Yeah, and I we're finding out, but I do think that the legwork is around, first off, identifying those issues where you can be a difference maker, where your institution can be a difference maker, And then, you know, there some of this is actually not some of the, I think the legwork around finding the funders is not necessarily the high, you know, like the technology driven stuff. It is like a lot of old school relationship based. Like, how do you, like, we're doing a lot of work with the Essex County Community Foundation here, who I need to shout out because I think that they're doing some leading work in creating what I would call like new capital delivery devices to institutions that are doing good work around issues that they at the ECCF have identified as strategically important for the region, right? So, and we're probably not going to have time to unpack this fully, which I think was one of the original things that we really wanted to talk about. But, you know, I think about impact investing as, again, another way, like I find myself evangelizing here on campus a bit about impact investing as a new means. Not that impact investing is a completely new idea, but I think some of the delivery devices for capital are new to our world. I know that 5 years ago, I was not talking to places like ECCF about like place-based impact capital, right? I had a vague idea, like from reading the Wall Street Journal, that like ESG and social responsible investing were things that Fidelity was opening a new SRI fund to help colleges, you know, quarantine their endowment funds from, you know, from investing in companies that would be unpopular among their students and alumni. But I didn't know, and I'm actually really in real time kind of finding out about place-based impact capital. Like, how do you set up sort of creative loan, find a capital partner who would set up a loan fund with very sort of unique and sort of mission-driven terms of a loan, right? With earn-out clauses where, you know, if a nonprofit or maybe a group, a partnering group of nonprofits get together on a problem and, you know, borrow money from a private foundation at sort of attractive terms that, and then they solve the problem that they were addressing, you know, trying to address, you know, whatever it is, hunger or the, you know, the nursing workforce shortage. If they can demonstrably show that the project that they launched address the issue in the way that they, you know, claimed they would, that there's some earnout potential. That private foundation says, all right, instead of paying us back at 2% a year as you know, as you had promised to, we're going to forgive that loan because you generated the impact. We're going to convert our loan into a grant, right? That's part of our mission as a private foundation. And so that sort of thinking, and I, you know, I'm not, you know, I don't have the time to fully unpack sort of what those terms can look like and what these deals can look like. That's an entirely new sort of like world
Do you
of
have
access to capital that we've missed.
are there peers in the case community or in the advancement community that you're riffing on these ideas with, or is it more kind of direct engagement with the funders that you're having right now? Like, I'm wondering, should we host some sort of forum or conversation where maybe others might be wrestling with some of the same kind of next generation structuring and approaches?
I'm eager to find peers who are really working in this space. I know that there are like on the like especially with some of the big national international foundations, there are some large funds getting generated with this sort of grant making or loan making. I'll call it alternatives, like in mind. I don't know of many peers of mine in the higher ed space or even with the healthcare space who are accessing this capital. I think that, you know, I had a call with Essex County Community Foundation last week. I recently had calls with there's a firm in Boston called Social Finance. Had a call with Bank of America. The capital is there, but in there, I think sort of happenstantially, if you'll allow me that word, finding investments to make in nonprofits or in ideas, but there's not a you know, what Wall Street would call like a market maker space. This is part of what ECCF is trying to do here locally in Essex County, is to jump into that void and start to, they have a great understanding of the nonprofit world here in Essex County. They have a decent sense of where capital is, you know, exists in the county. And they're trying to jump in to help make some of this connecting happen around, you know, ideas that promise to solve problems here in Essex County. But I think that there's a real misalignment or asymmetry between the amount of capital that's kind of piling up with this sort of ambition and the nonprofits or colleges or hospitals that are aware of the presence of that capital or how to access it.
Yeah.
And this is a real, I mean, I'm about, I would say, 2 months into even being exposed to this idea. So very much trying to like map it out on my own. But I just, if you know, I've been at this for 20 years. I feel like I've been paying attention to sort of like the vanguard of what's going on in the field. And if I'm as green to this idea as I am, I think it's probably the case that there aren't many directors of development out there who are super savvy about how to access this capital or talk. And in many cases, these sources of capital are foundations or private individuals who are probably already in your database.
Right.
And you just don't know to even have the conversation with them.
Right.
So I absolutely think that there could be a whole, you know, conference that there could be, you know, there could be a lot of conversation around this particular thing, this particular idea for accessing capital. And then I think this particular idea for accessing capital is just more an example of how development offices need to be this this force for expansive thinking on campus,
yeah.
right? Like we need
yeah.
to be, you know, the folks who are having conversations with partners beyond our campus, bringing those ideas that are fermenting off campus back to campus and helping our institutions think about, like, if I'm at Harvard right now and I just had $2 billion of research funding threatened, potentially taken off the table, there's not a lever, you know, none of us, you know, I don't care if you're Endicott or Harvard, no one has a lever to pull when $2 billion of current funding gets pulled off the table. There's just not a, you know, you can't admit, you know, 1,000 extra students to fill that void. So I think that we need to, that's both an emergency right now, and I think we need to be, you know, develop resilience in the systems for how we, you know, intake capital, how we pursue capital to keep our missions growing and thriving beyond just the traditional means that the traditional levers we pulled at this point.
I feel like this is going to be a to be continued, Pat. I know you got to run, but before we wrap, can you just, I meant to ask you two other things. One, quickly, mentors along the way. You mentioned Jim Zimmerman. Any shout outs you want to give just among people you look up to or learn from in this industry?
Yeah, I mean, Jim was definitely one of the most influential people I worked for. You know, I wouldn't say, and I don't know if you'll hear this, I wouldn't say that Jim was like easy to work for. I don't think that would bother him at all. I don't think he wanted to be easy to work for, but I probably learned more from my 4 years working under Jim than maybe any other person. I think that he's just a super talented person with real creativity. You know, didn't just accept things as they were. I think that his early buy-in with Evertrip is a good example of like he could see where the puck was going and it was good at skating to it. So that the way he thought, the way he didn't just settle, like definitely left an impression on me. I think about you know Scott Nichols, who was senior VP at BU when I was there. I think the way that he sort of like how to lead an institution, how to like build a structure that was, you know, sort of it was really effective and productive, how to, you know, work with the president on, you know, converting a compelling vision into a case for support. You know, I wish I had more like creative outside the box, you know, ideas, but I was very fortunate to work with people who I think were extremely good at what they did. And you know, just to, you know, to be alongside them and then also, you know, like, have that knowledge, you know, permeate. So those would be two I would single out.
Love it. And, a chance for the Endicott commercial. I know you're really bullish on Endicott's positioning right now in the midst of a lot of challenging higher ed headlines. Are you hiring, team building, you know, how should people stay in touch?
Yeah, we are. We've got actually two, thanks to, you know, this is as Evertrue's fingerprints on it, we've got two DXO positions. Our first ever DXO positions are posted currently. So there's an actual immediate opportunity here at Endicott. And then, yeah, I think the commercial for Endicott is, Endicott has changed radically. It's founded in 1939. It is It was a two-year women's college up until about 1990, and it has changed radically in the last 30 years. And I think that came out of a, you know, that had a sort of an existential moment around 1990. There weren't many two-year women's colleges at the time. And so what leadership at the time did was lean into, you know, Endicott's curriculum had been built purposely since its founding around an internship model. So the whole curriculum was built around internships. And that is serving us really well today. So I think that we have a great value proposition. I talked earlier about, you know, creating value. I think Endicott in its bones, you know, since its sort of recreation and reimagination of itself, like everyone on campus, you know, every faculty member, every coach has the culture here is around how are we creating value for our students. And I think that if you're, that's working super well for us. I think other than that idea of value creation and internship model, which people are really gravitating towards, when I say people, students and parents, tuition payers are really gravitating to. I understand what the Endicott value proposition is. I'm going to come out of Endicott with a job in my field of study, you know, and it's remunerative, and I, you know, that plays. And so some version, not every school has to turn itself into an internship factory like Northeastern or Endicott, but you better have a real, like, keen sense of what your unique value proposition is. And, you know, and that, you know, probably needs to be pretty well tuned into what people are looking for. They don't all have to be the same, but you have to know, you know, what it is that you're bringing special to the table. If you could also build your campus, you know, alongside four beaches in Beverly, Massachusetts, that probably would hurt you. You know, the physical beauty of the place is pretty spectacular. But I think that first part, you know, a real keen across the institution in the bones of the place around how we create value for students, and that's not a standstill target. That's constantly evolving. And I think that you could ask any faculty member here, and that is they intuitively understand that their challenge is to make their major or their courses or their lectures, you know, relevant to where the students are trying to go. And that's really, I think, kind of best sauce.
Love it, Pat. Well, hey, I would encourage anybody listening, please reach out to Pat. He's on LinkedIn, easy to find, obviously passionate and thinking deeply about the future of the industry. And thank you all for bearing with us through our walk down memory lane, but pretty special opportunity to reconnect with Pat. And so any closing thoughts, Pat?
We're going to have to do maybe a sidebar on youth football. I didn't get a chance to give my big pitch for youth football. I know Brent and I share a, you know, affection for the game and for passing on the next generation. So for a future podcast, or maybe that's just, you know, my next advancement trip to Puerto Rico.
We are kindred spirits in that we both have unpaid side hustles as youth football coaches. So we let you off easy on that topic, listeners, but maybe next time. But with that, I'll conclude today's episode with Pat Hewitt, who serves as Vice President for Institutional Advancement at Endicott College. Thanks, Pat, and take care, everybody.
Thank you, Brent.